Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 23, Episode 16. Coming up on the show, we've got the Egyptian Curse of Hawass, Gog Magog the Giant, and how Loch Ness Monster is connected to King Kong and Hitler. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
I'm not so sure about Hitler. I get King Kong from just the association of the size. But Hitler, how does Hitler play a role?
They're all monsters.
I would have failed the test. Mm. Yeah, right, yep.
What have you got coming up today?
Well, we're going to go into Gog Magog, which is this little story that I ran across after you did your fantastic description of pygmies being destroyed by cranes.
Yes.
I wanted to look into more stories from history that show that, you know, they seem to be legends. They sound like they're legends. They sound like they're just fantasy and fiction. But when you start peeling back the layers a little bit somewhere in history, you find that there might be some evidence that these things actually took place, they actually existed. So there's this story, there's this superstition in the UK about this particular hill known as the Gog Magog Hills. And in these hills, there are these large chalk drawings or outlines.
But it's the guy with the club and the big erect penis.
That's right, yes. There's a rather large erect penis chalked out with that. That is correct.
I was playing a video game recently. In that new Assassin's Creed Vikings game. They have that hill in the game.
Oh, really?
But they censored out the dick.
Why?
So it's just a guy on a hill with a club. Like, what are you doing? Oh. Why are you bleeping that out? Like, you're chopping guys' heads off every 5 minutes, and then you have to censor this guy.
Yeah, violence, that's fine. But nudity, no, you can't have that. Well, it ties back to the work of Thomas Lethbridge. Now, Thomas Lethbridge was an archaeologist at Oxford. And from what I understand, his research into Gog Magog, this giant, and this is the important thing, is that Gog Magog was a giant, alleged giant, 18 feet tall was this guy. And he was part of a race that were giants that inhabited this area for a very long time until they were wiped out when a new group of people came through. It's just typical. It happens in history all the time. And what happened to Lethbridge is that he found out all these strange superstitions but experienced one himself, which caused him to go and look for the burial site of Gog Magog, which almost ended up bringing down his entire career at Oxford.
That's the thing. You never mess with giants if you want to keep your archaeological career.
Yeah, well, look, he was...
suicide.
Look, it's funny because he was... what's the term for him? I mean, they say privately funded, independently wealthy. So he didn't have to care about what Oxford was doing. Like, oh, no, we won't give you any funding for that. He's like, well, fuck it. You know, I'll just go and do it myself. And off he did. And that's exactly what he did. But yeah, the poor guy. And I've only got sort of the first section of this story. I want to go into much greater detail because I found out this afternoon, Ben, as you pointed out, that he actually published a full book on Gog Magog back in the 1930s or 40s.
I've got the PDF on my desktop right now, 1957.
Oh, 57, right, okay.
So and I think I'm going to cover it.
Yeah, just steal it from me.
I'm the one that's got the file.
I'm sure I can find it if I do a little bit of sleuthing.
Anything prior 1970 is your forte, I think.
Well, yeah, it's normally with 1970 stuff, it's all paperback. You can never find it in a digital version, so I'm pleased that is there. But
Does it have ye olde language from the 1950s?
This did, and this is what Lethbridge encountered. And what was crazy for Lethbridge, and this is what I find, I mean, it's crazy, but it's also fascinating at the same time, is that Lethbridge had to go through all these old reports and books from historians, right? And when he was pulling out manuscripts, he was getting them from 1150. So ye olde English, he was getting these reports from 1150.
Yeah, I'm just reading the end of the first chapter now, and he's really setting it up. He's saying, here, as often as not, a missing hill figure may well lie beneath the turf.
Yes. So there may be a giant skeleton below there, although considering
and if the anatomical depictions in the chalk outline
are correct, giant.
What a giant.
Yes, a giant in all sense of the word.
Well, I went into Ray Grass's new book, The Sky Stretched Out Before Me, Encounters with Mystics, Anomalies, and Waking Dreams. I haven't actually read any of this guy's work.
I'm not familiar with his name.
He's well known for astrology and synchronicities.
Oh, cool.
And one of his books, or his most well-known book, is called The Waking Dream, which came out in 2013. It's all about unlocking the symbolic language of our lives. So his take on synchronicities is that they have a deep meaning for the individual, but they're also connected to almost like a group zeitgeist.
Yeah, I've heard that because, I mean, I think it was it John Keel that always said that, you know, synchronicities, on top of being very personal, were also kind of an indication that you're on this right path, like something, but they didn't connect to anyone else.
Something might happen to you personally. You'll see a bird when your grandma dies or something, and for you that's very personal. But there's events that happen on sometimes a global scale, or at least a large cultural scale, that are glaring synchronicities that seem to shift culture.
Yeah, push a population in a certain direction.
That's what he specializes in. But this new book, The Sky Stretched Out Before Me, is a semi-autobiography / collection of essays.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I hadn't read any of his stuff, so I wasn't sure what I was getting into. But he describes a lot of experiences from childhood, takes you through major moments of his life. And he's quite a good writer too. He grew up in Chicago, working class parents, studied art in college, and eventually moved into writing. And he's quite an excellent artist. But he tells this story from when he was in art school, where he loved the Renaissance. Like, he went into art school wanting to learn the techniques of Da Vinci and Michelangelo and the great Italian masters, and just really hone his technique. And for one of his first major projects, he was tasked with, you know, painting on a theme. And he painted this kind of almost like Renaissance style man lying back on clouds with like a heavenly backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
And he remembers, he was really proud of it. And he remembers handing it in to his art professor, and his art professor just said,
"This is gauche.
This is not the Renaissance. This is the 1970s. You need to splash a bit of semen on it or something."
Like, put a car in the background.
He really became so disillusioned because everything was about making things abstract.
Yeah.
Making things twisted and distorted. And he just wanted to
classical beauty,
create beautiful art and hone his technique and recapture the greats of the past. But he eventually just left the field. He changed to writing because everyone that was teaching it was like, "No, it needs to be, gather some candy and put it in the corner and put your dirty underpants on top and that'll get you an A+.
You've never gotten over that, have you?
In the Chicago Museum we went to. Now, he talks about his spiritual leanings as well. Like, when he went to college, he found his first spiritual master. He began to study under Goswami Kriyananda. And don't let the name fool you. His real name was Melvin Higgins, and he was from Chicago.
Where did he get that new age name?
You just get it. That's the thing.
Yeah, right.
You sign up for a yoga course and you get a cool new name. But he ran this Kriya Yoga Center in the heart of Chicago. And Ray spent a lot of time there as a young man. And he has this bunch of chapters on back and forth between him and this yogi. And I'm not going to bore you with any of it.
Great.
It's very love and light and very predictable kind of yogic stuff from the 1970s.
Yeah.
But it's the strange synchronicities that occur to Ray that make his story really interesting. And also the meaning he sees in them. Like, one of the first ones he shares is, it was around the year 2000, and one of his friends asked him to give a talk on Egypt to this study group on the south side of Chicago. And he tells a story of, you know, catching the train into the city and then going to the south side. And he had the huge stack of photographs he had taken while he was in Egypt. And I'll talk about an expedition he did later in the show. And he had these, you know, beautiful big prints of the Great Pyramid and this temple of Osiris he went into and this undiscovered chamber that he and some colleagues found. And he did this amazing presentation. Now, of course, he says, when you do presentations on Egypt, people always ask about curses.
Of course.
It's the first question.
Well, yeah, Howard Carter straight away.
They started to ask about the curse of Tutankhamun's tomb. And Ray explained that among the unusual deaths following the opening of that tomb, there was a fellow named Richard Bethell, the personal secretary of Howard Carter, who you just mentioned. Carter was, of course, the chief discoverer of the tomb.
Who didn't have any problems, by the way. You'd think that if there's going to be a curse, if you're the primary person, you're the project manager opening up that tomb.
That's because he's like the stereotypical villain in a movie who gets the underlings to go through the traps first.
That's a good point. That's probably exactly what happened.
But Richard Bethell, he was found dead in his bed one day, suffocated with a pillow. So it was a unsolved murder. Then his father, Lord Westbury, fell to his death from a 7th-floor window. And I find these falling out of a window deaths very suspicious. Who falls out of a window? No one's falling out of a window.
It is strange. Is it just a polite way of reporting a suicide, or is it actually that it's they've recorded it as an accidental death?
Well, one of the theories floating around there, because these are undiscovered deaths. Oh, sorry, not undiscovered. They're unsolved. Unsolved. Mm-hmm. One of the theories floating around is that they were murdered by Aleister Crowley.
What? Yeah. I wouldn't put it past him, yeah. But why? You mean like supernaturally or Aleister Crowley in drag, like coming through, pushing a guy out the window?
Yeah, he dressed up as a maid and offered them some hors d'oeuvres or something and shoved him out the window. That's likely what happened. Right. I didn't look into the theory, but apparently it's a theory that's out there. We should look into that later. But he gave this talk, and then after the talk, he got back onto the train and he headed back to the city and then made it back to the western suburbs. And when he got home, he realized he'd left his photos and all his notes on the train. And he was really upset because these were the original photographs, you know, very expensive prints. And he's like, oh my gosh, what a nightmare. And he immediately thought, I've got to get these back. So the next morning he called the lost and found office for the railway, and amazingly someone had handed them in. So that morning he goes down and he goes to collect his photos. When he gets to the office, there's a young man there, and the young man hands over the envelope with the photos in them. And just before Ray's about to say thanks and leave, the young man says, oh, by the way, I had a peek at your photos and they're really interesting. And he said, you know, I have a family connection to Egypt. And Ray's like, oh, really? What's the connection? He said, well, a couple of relatives of mine were directly involved with the King Tut discovery and the mysterious deaths.
Were they underlings?
Well, Ray's like, okay, well, who are you connected to? And he looks down at this clerk's badge, and his last name is Bethel.
Oh.
So as it turned out, he was directly related to Richard Bethel, who was found murdered, suffocated by a pillow, and he obviously related to Lord Westbury as well, who was pushed out the window by Aleister Crowley in drag. And he said, if I hadn't lost the photos on the train, I never would have met this guy.
Yeah, see, it all happens for a reason.
And he says these moments, he likes them because they're entertaining. They're fun.
Like, they are
synchronicities
fun.
Are fun.
Yeah.
But obviously there's something deeper going on. And he says these experiences hint at deeper truths. He says anomalies can be paradigm shifting and serve as haunting reminders of life's mysteriousness, prompting us to peer just a little bit further behind that cloudy veil of appearances. Now, he talks about a bunch of kind of weird childhood stuff that happened as well. One afternoon when he was 11, he was sitting in the kitchen with his mother, and his mother was, you know, cooking something or doing something in the kitchen. And all of a sudden she just stopped and went, ah, something's wrong. Something's wrong with your father. And he's like, what do you mean, Mum? What's going on? Because his dad at the time was working downtown on a construction site.
Uh-oh.
But his mother swore that she heard him scream her name as if he was in severe pain.
So this is extraordinary knowing.
So she's calling him, trying to get through. There's no answer. And, you know, she's pacing back and forth furiously. Finally, about an hour later, she gets a call and it's him. He's at the doctor's office. He had stepped on a nail and it went through his foot.
Oh, but this is a weird thing, because you hear about this in Phantasms of the Living. That was put together by SPR. You saw just so many reports of this, of people knowing when their partner or their lover was in trouble. There was one story I remember, that there was a guy that was in, he was staying with his sister on a ship, and his sister was mortified one night because they woke up, or she woke up in the bunk to find this lady like caressing her husband.
Oh.
And she's just like, how dare you? And she gets up. Yeah, exactly. That's what she thought. And she gets up. And of course, the figure is ephemeral and just disappears.
Right.
But she later finds out that it was actually a fiance or something, which she hadn't met yet. So she didn't know who she was. And she was pining for her fiance so much that she somehow astrally traveled over and connected. You know, so stories like that kind of pop up, you know, quite frequently. But normally, it involves high levels of emotion. It's like almost near death or pining for someone. Not if you step on a nail.
Yeah, but I mean, she's saying that she heard him scream her name, which is that just how she perceived the connection? Or did he actually step on a nail and scream his wife's name? I find that kind of funny.
Oh, I think
like that's stub your toe and I'm like, Teresa!
Yeah, you're halfway around the world. So, uh-oh. Something's happened.
He had a story similar in a way to what you're just talking about, because he described staying at a friend's house as a kid, like 15, 16, and he kept on feeling a tap on his shoulder, and he turned around, there was nothing there. He's like, that was weird. And then it would happen again, but it would feel very much like a hand grabbing his shoulder.
Yes, it's not a mistake by any means.
And he told his friend about it, whose house it was, and his friend said, oh my God, you would not believe what I've been going through. And his friend just opened up on how horrible this new house had been. The worst was when he got undressed, he would hear this female giggle, like this kind of laughing at him when he was getting changed. And then it progressed to something touching him when he was in bed at night, until something eventually like pushed him up against the wall and started groping him and touching him. And they ended up bringing in, like, the parents brought in a psychic or someone to cleanse the house. And they said there was like a horny teenage girl there that had taken a fancy to the poor kid, some girl that had died and was just
stuck in the house,
a perpetual horny 16-year-old girl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so there's a bunch of stories like this. He has, I don't know if this next one is strange as in paranormal. It depends on how you look at it. I did some research on it. I think it is. When he was 12, he said he saw this segment on TV, and it was about an opera singer who could supposedly shatter a wine glass using only her voice. It wasn't a demonstration. It was just like them telling a story, like a legend or something. And it intrigued him so much that afternoon, when the house was nice and quiet and his father was at work and his mother was doing something, he went and sat in the dining room, and his family had this really nice crystal bowl in the middle of the nice dining room.
Uh-oh.
So he sits down, and with all his like mental focus, he starts staring at this bowl and he wants it to smash. And he just tries to make the loudest, most obnoxious noise he can. And he's like, trying to get this bowl to crack, and nothing happens. So he does it again. And he said he's just focusing intently on this crystal bowl. And he said it was like the fifth ear-piercing screech that he let out. And it just collapsed and shattered across the dining room table. And his mother's like, what the hell are you doing? She comes in, there's glass everywhere. And he had to explain, oh, I tried to shatter it with my voice.
Yeah, I think there is something at least maybe psychokinetic going on there, because surely just reeing a lot is not, well, maybe, but it's not in that circumstance, yeah, I think, going to be enough to shatter a bowl.
I did a bit of searching on this, and you can shatter glass with sound.
Of course you can,
and
yeah.
You apparently can do it with your voice, but it's very, very difficult. Like, you have to match the resonant frequency of the glass. And then I started to look at experiments where people had done this, and most people claim that you could only do it with an amplifier.
And Yoko Ono.
And the ultimate decibel level in one experiment I was reading was 140 decibels to get the glass to break.
Isn't that like the sound of a Concorde?
That's a shotgun blast right next to your ear.
Right.
That's 140 decibels. 130 decibels is like a jumbo jet taking off near your head.
Yep. it's very, very loud.
The fact that he's saying he's focusing all his will on it, and also he must have believed it was possible,
yeah,
because he had watched the TV show the day before, so maybe there is something paranormal to it. I just thought it was funny that you'd have a kid shrieking at a bowl in the living room.
But when you think about it, right, so, I mean, this has potentially formed his entire belief system going through his life, because obviously it forms, you know, belief in itself. Like, the fact that this guy believes that he could influence, you know, the outcome of physical objects, well, then it kind of ties in with what he's talking about with synchronicities influencing people. It's the same kind of thing. It's like intent is playing a role in people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And later on, when he talks about getting out of high school and going to college, like I said, he went to the Art Institute of Chicago. He became close friends with a film student named Billy Hogan. And he said in 1972, Billy had a plan for them to go and shoot some footage off the coast of California for a film he was working on. And Ray decided to tag along. He thought it'd be great to go to California. And he ended up, you know, getting some footage as well, and like working on his art project or whatever he was doing at the time. They said, we even managed to convince our instructor, John Schofield, to join up and drive us all down to the coast during spring break, because he had family there. Now, he said, we spent a little bit over a week exploring the Bay Area. We went to San Francisco and Mill Valley and Berkeley. We even went to Big Sur. And he said, the week we spent out there opened my mind in a number of ways. most of it due to a LSD experience. And the way he got LSD was through the instructor from the college.
It's art, so yeah, of course.
They somehow got wind that the instructor knew some people who could get LSD, so they begged him to get acid, and he just gave them acid. And so he tells this story of walking around like someone's garden or at someone's property. And he started to, you know, one of the typical things we hear, he started to predict what his friend Bill was going to say before he said it. He had this moment of ESP. But what was really shocking to him is that as he was exploring the fauna and flora of this garden, he started to sense these faint sounds coming from the nearby bushes and the flowers. It's almost like this. And he's like, what is that? It didn't sound like a normal sound. He said it was almost like he was feeling the sound rather than hearing it, for lack of a better description. But at one point, it finally dawned on him that the sounds were coming from the plants themselves. Like, he had this moment.
Baxter stuff.
That they were like singing. They were having this singing moment. And he said, as soon as he had that thought, the entire garden just started laughing at him. They were just teasing him, saying, you know, of course we're talking. What's wrong with you? And then they're laughing and cracking jokes. And it's like they were delighted that he was perceiving their communication. He doesn't give any details on like a back and forth or anything, but he said for the next hour, he just sat there communicating with all the plants, and they were projecting different emotions and singing songs. And it was really bizarre. Now, he had doubts about this, just thinking, well, maybe it's just a drug-induced hallucination.
Sure, you know,
maybe
there's not
any validity to this. But he wanted a second informed opinion. So I remember I mentioned that guru that he had in Chicago, Goswami Kriyananda. He went and asked him what he thought about this experience. And on hearing the details, this Goswami said, oh, it's real for sure, but your experience was very limited. And Ray thought, what do you mean by limited? And the Goswami said, everything is actually conscious. This is the thing. Your awareness had opened up only far enough to pick up the consciousness of the plants. Had it opened up further, you would have been able to sense the awareness of the rocks, the clouds, the trees, everything.
Panpsychism.
Now, the reason this Goswami understood this isn't because, you know, that's what he had read or, you know, that's what he had learned from another teacher. It's because a few years earlier, he had been in this really deep meditation. And as he was coming out of it, he opened his eyes and his dog was sitting in front of the fireplace in front of him and chewing on a bone. And as he kind of came out of this hypnotic meditative state, he heard this, not really a sentence, but just a feeling. It's like he heard this feeling, and the feeling was this, oh, yeah. Oh, it feels so good. And as I'm reading this, I'm like, okay, yeah, he's hearing the dogs enjoying the bone. No, he was hearing the consciousness of the bone. The bone had some weird rudimentary awareness.
That loved being chewed on.
And it appreciated being devoured by the dog. The bones was like, oh, yeah, just bite into my back. Oh, yeah, give it to me. Like, it really loved being chewed on, like that was its purpose.
It's fulfilling its purpose.
And it's funny because I've heard stuff like that before. Like someone mentioned to me that this is why you have to finish all the food on your plate.
Yes.
Because if you don't eat all your carrots, for example, and you throw them in the bin.
No!
Yeah, their whole life purpose, their destiny is to be eaten by you. It's kind of the opposite of that animated Seth Rogen film where all the food is screaming because it's being consumed. It's the opposite of
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
The food wants to be consumed.
Yep.
That's its goal, is to feel the joy of being eaten.
Where have we heard that, though? I think in some panpsychism stories, we've heard that about objects as well. Because I remember it was something along the lines of that story that we covered. It was where, I think it was the bedspread.
Yeah.
Like, it was sad. Oh, no.
Well, I do remember one, I can't remember the author's name, but he tapped into the consciousness of his handgun. And his handgun was like, oh, I just want to be held. Like, I just want someone to grab me and blam, blam. Like,
yeah, that's his job.
It wanted the feel of being gripped by its master.
Oh, it was like the suitcase under the stairs.
Yeah.
But it was sad because it was left under the stairs. But when it was fulfilling its purpose,
yeah,
it was happy.
Yeah.
I like that concept.
Yeah, that's why you shouldn't hoard useless objects.
Yeah, exactly. They've got to serve a purpose.
You should destroy them. And there's another weird one he mentioned where is the, again, early 70s, so this is around college time, and he went to the summer cottage of a childhood friend. And actually, this must have been later in life because he said they were friends during the 1970s. He said he'd driven up from Illinois across the border into Wisconsin, spent the day with his friend, and then he ended up sleeping in the spare bedroom. And while he was lying in bed, these weird images started to enter his mind, like not just thinking about them, but almost floating in front of his vision while his eyes were closed. And it was almost like he was on drugs. Like it was so psychedelic and weird, these strange, foreign, vivid pageantry of mental imagery flowing over him, like he was watching someone else's dream. It was just the weirdest thing he's ever experienced. And he didn't really sleep very well. And it was just this crazy night of his mind going wacky. And he saw faces of people and locations he didn't recognize. It was completely foreign. Even if you have a dream, it's like you know people that you see in the dream, or you notice locations. He just, everything was totally Dutch to him. The next morning over breakfast, he mentions this experience to his friend. He's like, dude, last night was so weird. I just had all these visions. It was crazy. And his friend just started laughing. And so Ray's like, what's so funny? And his friend said, that's the bed that I used to lie in whenever I did LSD and mescaline years ago.
So had it absorbed his experience?
Yeah, he said, mate, I've done like 50 trips lying in that bed. I've done so many drugs in that bed. So yeah, it's almost like there's this weird psychedelic psychic residue that has merged with the object. So when he's kind of lying in it, he's somehow absorbing it, soaking it up.
I'd never considered that. That's insane.
Isn't that strange? That's why set and setting would be so important to psychedelic, shamanic experiences as well.
Absolutely. But this is all very, like Japanese superstition in a way as well. It's like this idea, like with the kami or the yokai, the yokai can influence people. There's also this idea as well that by putting certain thoughts, again, intention, into an object, it then will like cough it up like a poker machine. Like it'll pay it out.
Yeah, right.
And so depending, like you might hold an object and you'll be fine, but then another person comes along and holds it and they pick up on all the stuff that comes out of it.
That's why that psychic friend of mine saw that weird whirling ball of energy in our recording studio, the last recording studio.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It just gets soaked up.
But this is why it might explain why things are attached to like this idea of bad luck and curses being associated with objects retrieved from grave sites, such as, the Titanic is one example, or Egypt.
On that note, he had a little story, which I wasn't going to mention, but he spoke about going to, I can't remember where it was, but it was a Native American site. Mm-hmm.
Reservation or like, was it a megalith?
It was just like old ruins. I can't even remember what it was, but it was part of some tourist thing, right? Like near a national park. And he ended up taking pebbles. And as he took the first one, just on a whim, just like grabbed a pebble from the ground, put it in his pocket. And when he grabbed the second one, he was like, oh, hang on a second. Isn't there stories about you shouldn't take things from the reservation or something like that? And he's like, nah, that's ridiculous. And then he takes a third rock, right? So he's got three rocks in his pocket. When he gets back to his car that's parked in the national park, his window is smashed. And
please tell me by a tomahawk.
His windows are smashed and three items have been stolen from him. His camera, one of his expensive lenses, and something else like the camera bag or something.
It's like an eye for an eye. He's taken three rocks.
Three rocks and three items got stolen. So he didn't think about it until he drove home and he was like, three rocks, three stolen items. He ended up mailing the rocks back to the reservation and telling them to put it back.
Suddenly rematerialize somewhere?
No, it's lesson learned. There was a weird one that was connected with UFOs as well. And he does mention a couple of UFO experiences. He says there was an odd chain of circumstances where he crossed paths during the early 1990s with Tom Stultz. And Tom Stultz was the president of the Illinois chapter of MUFON at the time. And they had connected because at the time Ray had made friends with an original eyewitness at Roswell, apparently someone who saw the remains or saw the debris, and this guy knew Tom, so put them in touch. Tom eventually invited Ray and his wife, Judy, to a couple of MUFON meetings. And Ray found them really interesting because he went expecting everyone to be cranks. But no, there was like research chemists and computer specialists and psychologists and really intelligent people that would attend these meetings. And one time they got invited to go to a meeting that Tom said, look, this one's going to be a bit out of the ordinary. So immediately Ray said, great, let's go. I'll bring my wife. This will be fun. Now, as they were driving to this house for the event, Tom explained that the speaker of the night was going to be talking about UFOs with the added detail that he could communicate with the pilots.
Great.
Directly. So Ray says he and his wife just look at each other and go, okay, let's see how this goes. Now, Tom, the MUFON director, he didn't really believe the guy's claims, but apparently there'd been some phenomenon surrounding this kid. So they thought, let's go and, you know, give him his time and see what happens. Now, when they arrive, this young man has this huge, thick notebook. It reminds me of that time that we went to one of the, we went to Stephen and Evan Strong's event in Sydney.
The last one.
And they had an intermission, and this young woman came out and she said, my boyfriend's an extraterrestrial. His name's Zothar.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and he's from the Sirius B system. And this is his blood brother, Zonkator, who's a reptile. And she didn't give any context. She just started plowing into this madness of all these different ETs. It was actually the best thing about the day. And this guy was kind of the same. He had this huge notebook with all these drawings of alien races and ETs, ultra-terrestrials, para-terrestrials, trans-terrestrials, like every kind of terrestrial you could think of. And he was just neck deep in this topic, obviously. And Ray said, we all sat in a circle. And once the meeting was underway, it became a seance that the lights came down. And he ended up taking them through this meditation to contact the alien intelligences who were supposedly hovering in UFOs above the meeting. And he asked everyone in the circle if they had any questions for the unseen alien guests. So it's very much just like a seance. It's like a channeling session, a mediumship session. Now, obviously, Ray is super skeptical. His wife is super skeptical as well. When it came time for his wife to ask a question, Judy, she basically said, can you give us any proof that these aliens are real and not just figments of your young mind, your imagination? And she said, anytime during the evening, just provide some evidence. That will be fine. So he basically said, okay, we'll see what we can do, like while he was channeling. So when they left home that night, Ray and his wife, Judy, are just like, that was batshit insane. How crazy was that? Let's just go home. They ended up going home. Later that night, Ray just immediately fell asleep. He was really tired. But Judy stayed awake. She was just reading the week's mail, sitting on the edge of the bed. And she said, suddenly a basketball-sized sphere of light suddenly appeared outside their bedroom window and proceeded to float through the window into their bedroom without breaking the glass, glided slowly in her direction. She tried to wake Ray up, but amazingly, he was dead to the world. He couldn't wake up. And he said, this is weird because he's a super light sleeper. He'll wake up at the sound of a drop of a pin. She couldn't wake him up. And this glowing sphere floats right up to her face and then just goes pew, and explodes in this flash of light with no noise at all, leaving no trace. Now, as startling as all that was, she inexplicably reclined back and went straight to sleep. Didn't try and wake Ray, didn't write anything down, didn't go, oh, what was that? Just went straight to sleep. It's almost like she was in a trance throughout the whole experience. The next morning, she tells Ray what had happened and she didn't really know what to think about it. And she hadn't made the connection. He had to point out, hello, remember last night you asked for proof? And then it finally clicked. It's like that was obscured from her mind for some reason, or she'd blocked out that she'd actually asked for proof of the aliens' existence.
Is she absolutely sure she hadn't dreamt it?
Oh, no, she's 100% sure. She was wide awake.
Yep.
Now, the interesting thing, and I think you got to credit Ray's wisdom for this, he thinks back to the gathering the night before and he says, you know, that was just really like a seance. And the way that it was arranged and the way the night proceeded was like an invocation. It's like we summoned something. And this, he asked the question, did the group conjure something up that night? Possibly, but it may well have been something quite different from aliens, which I think is pretty accurate, pretty accurate guess. Now, this is where he kind of, because these are all essays, one of them is really about the meaning of synchronicity. And it's fun to mention all these stories, but he really dives into the symbolic meaning of these events. One, he talks about he was just 13 at the time, sitting with a friend on a front porch of his home, you know, talking about whatever 13-year-olds talk about. And there was an odd light he noticed in the corner of his eye, and his friend noticed it as well. And they turn and look, and this bright glowing disc just starts rising up over the trees about half a mile away, shaped like a hamburger bun, he said. Lights, you know, cream colored lights around its fringe, incredible UFO sighting, and it basically flies away. Without going into too much detail, he tries to report it, and the, I think he called the local airport or something, and they just told him it was a blimp.
Blimp.
Yeah, and there actually was a blimp around that night.
But that's not a blimp.
But they saw that 40 minutes later, and they obviously knew a flying disc is not a blimp. But over the years, you know, this experience lasted about 40 seconds, but over the years he's realized that these synchronicities are symbolic events. A synchronicity is fundamentally a symbol. It's a...
The symbols!
He says, according to various mystical traditions throughout history, our universe can be thought of as an expression of mind stuff, more akin to our nightly dreams than the solid world described by strict materialists. He says, for that reason, outer events can be interpreted in much the same way as dream images, concealing layers of symbolism beyond their surface appearances. According to this worldview, all phenomena interlock in a profound and intricate way, that reflects the workings of a vast intelligence, or what Buddhists might refer to as big mind. Nothing is chance, he says. Nothing is disconnected from the whole. As such, synchronicities, isolated dramatic coincidences, are actually just the tip of a larger iceberg of meaningfulness that extends throughout our lives, and in turn, the entire cosmos. And this is why I want to check out more of this guy's work, because very few authors document a lot of synchronicities, but then try and figure out the meaning behind them.
Yes.
Like, yeah, it's easy to compile them, but you got to figure out what's the point.
This is the problem with it, because synchronicities tend to be so personalized. Mm. It's difficult for a researcher to be able to take personal experiences and then find a greater picture.
Well, the angle with Ray is that he's an astrologer.
That would play a role in it.
He has this interesting angle, and he says he's consistently found that these strange events are paralleled with significant planetary configurations. He says, years after my incident with the glowing disc, seeing that hamburger bun-shaped UFO, he said, I was intrigued to look back, and I discovered that my experience happened precisely as Uranus was forming a powerful relationship to my personal horoscope, a planetary energy normally associated with surprising or even shocking new insights or experiences in life. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's a synchronicity in itself, right? He says, as I'll continue to show here, understanding planetary patterns can sometimes be a useful key for teasing out the subtler inflections of anomalous events. So there's this weird astrological side to this. One of the next events he mentions was this haunting he had during his high school years. He was lounging upstairs in his bedroom reading a book, and he hears these really heavy footsteps coming up the stairs. And he's like, I swear, I was the only one home. And they're getting closer and closer, and very defined, clear footsteps. It's an old staircase, and he knows there's 13 steps. Gets to gets to the top of the stairs.
Hear it creaking.
And then there's nothing. There's no sound. He opens the door. There's no one there. He searches the house. There's no one there. He's completely alone. And it's this weird haunting. And he says, in contrast to the UFO he had seen several years earlier, which coincided with all these new radical ideas in his life, which again coincided with the astrological timing, that ghostly encounter of the footsteps going up the stairs, he said that coincided with problems I was struggling to let go of and simply forget.
What does he mean?
He says specifically the day before He had an extremely painful social situation at school. He doesn't say what it was. You know, maybe a kid pulled his pants down at assembly or something, like something awful. But he was being haunted by this event from the day before. He couldn't stop thinking about it. He's just dwelling on it, haunted by it.
So what, is he suggesting it somehow manifested externally and then walked up the stairs?
He's not saying that directly, but he's saying there is a connection. Like the synchronicity, it's the symbolism,
I like
the symbolism of the synchronicity. The meaning is he's being haunted by something, but he's also being haunted by his inner thoughts. There's something there. And he then goes into, like, that's a very personal thing for him, but he goes into the idea of the collective dimension, the idea that these synchronistic meanings can hold significance beyond the individual. They can actually apply to a whole community or a whole culture or the entire earth. So one example he talks about is, you probably remember this story, June 2013. Remember there was that museum in, I think it was in London, and they had an Egyptian statuette on display.
Yeah, the spinning one.
And it would turn.
Yeah.
And
they were saying, oh, it's just the heat of the halogen lamps. It's like, well, the LED.
There was a bunch of possible explanations. They ended up putting in surveillance cameras because all the guards and, you know, people at night would say, no, this statue is turning and no one's touching it. It would actually pivot and
they caught it on film.
It turned 180 degrees around. And that's right. After they installed the surveillance cameras, you can clearly see it spinning around. Who knows why? I mean, one other suggestion would that it was vibrations from a nearby train, like a subway train. But then no other artifacts were showing movement in that way. So who knows what it was.
I seem to recall from that story as well, though, there was some, apparently that statue itself had a curse attached to it.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, there was like a curse that was in Manchester. And what was it? There was, I'll find it for you and let you know, because apparently I recall this, I was exactly the same. When I heard there was a curse attached to it, through just research that we were incidentally doing, I went, oh, well, there you go. That's why.
I should have looked it up. Would have been another good curse story for the episode.
It was called Nebsanu, which was the statue of the man.
Can you put the link in the show notes?
I will, yes. Yeah.
The question he's asking is, why did this occurrence, why did this strange anomaly occur then and there? And why was there such a media sensation around it at this time? What's specific about the timing? And he says this was only weeks before the Arab Spring, where the Egyptian president was, you know, remember he was removed after the mass protests that lasted for weeks and then months and it spread throughout the Middle East. This symbol, remember, it was within the psyche of people at the time as well, because it made news all around the world. Globally. We covered it on the show.
Yeah.
This Egyptian artifact turning about face, turning 180 degrees, yeah, going in another direction, which is precisely what happened with politics to a degree in the Middle East. Then he starts talking about Roswell. He talks about the crash, of course, in New Mexico in 1947, Kenneth Arnold's sightings of flying discs in Washington State in 1947. And then several days before that, you had the Puget Sound, Maury Island case with a bunch of UFOs seen by Harold Dahl, six UFOs, and a Men in Black encounter that followed. And he links these sightings of futuristic craft that at that precise time to a sense of optimism that's emerging after World War II, the idea that anything's possible.
Yes.
It's opening up our minds to new horizons. Anything could be out there. It's like this, the psyche was ripe for the anomalous event, hence the symbolic synchronicity of it. And again, he goes into the astrology of the time. So precisely when all three of these incidents took place, the planet Uranus was just completing its second full circuit around the zodiac from where it was positioned on its discovery in 1781, a Uranus return, as astrologers refer to it. Now, this is interesting because Uranus keeps coming up all the time with these anomalous events. He says symbolically, Uranus is the planet of revolution, aviation, flying discs, and innovation, new technology. So a return to its place in the zodiac origin clearly signals an amplification of progressive trends and paradigms in the collective consciousness arena. And he says the next major return of Uranus, the next ripe time period for
Please don't
this.
Tell me now. Please don't tell me it's now. Please don't tell me 2020.
2030 to 2031.
Oh, okay.
That's when it's all going to be kicking off.
We can be ready for that. We can handle that. That's fine. It gives us a little bit of time.
Yeah, we can warm up to that.
Yeah.
And they're not surprised because he started to take on the Patterson Gimlin film. The famous Bigfoot film, you know, the loping female Sasquatch from October the 20th, 1967. And he says, look, if you examine this footage, and he's not talking about the validity of the footage, but you got to think of it in terms of the impact it had on society, the popularity of how it spread.
Of
people were
it
amazed
did.
By this.
Yeah.
And the debate on whether it was real, and it just really entered the zeitgeist. He says, purely looking at the terms of the imagery, looking at that film, it's like you're examining someone's dream symbolism. He says the creature in the footage is obviously wild and untamed and halfway between human and animal, straddling the threshold between civilization and nature. The creature is entirely naked and covered with fur, yet it stands upright and walks similar to how a human walks. Its muscular figure conveys a sense of enormous power, yet at the same time, it has large pendulous breasts. He says if you look at it from the perspective of a collective dream symbol, the appearance of this creature in 1967 can be read as signaling something primal surfacing from the wilds of the collective consciousness, collective unconsciousness to be specific, an energy paradoxically both ancient and new. The figure embodies great power, yet its feminine gender hints at a consciousness that is more right-brained and intuitive than anything purely aggressive or animalistic. It personifies a consciousness midway between ordered civilization and untamed nature, betwixt pure rationality and raw emotional impulses. I've never thought so deeply about a big hairy Sasquatch chick in the wilderness before.
No, is he connecting it with the times, like being the 60s, being a revolution?
Yeah, so
freedom.
This is where it gets interesting because he starts looking at the time period, like what was going on, not just in the 60s in general, that's too easy. What was going on specifically around the time of October the 20th, 1967? When the Patterson Gimlin footage was captured. First of all, 2 days before the encounter, October the 18th, Disney Studios released the popular animated feature, Jungle Book. The film scenario revolves around a boy raised by animals in the wild and follows his escapades as he mingles on the threshold between nature and civilization.
It's a bit of a stretch, though.
Just like it's not just one example. One day before that, on October the 17th, an enormously successful musical premieres on Broadway.
Hair.
I love that you know that. I love it. The musical's title itself hints at how the hippies at the show's core shunned the neatly groomed fashions of mainstream society in favor of a wilder, more natural look.
I guess some people did look like Sasquatch walking through the woods at that point with all the hair, so yeah, I get it.
And get this, the musical became especially controversial for a scene in which all the cast members
naked.
Are on stage fully naked, just like Sasquatch, naked in the woods. Less than a week earlier, October the 12th, Desmond Morris's best-selling book, The Naked Ape, was released. Now, this was a popular attempt to frame human nature within Darwinian evolution, he says. It's kind of suggesting that we need to think of humans as just another animal species.
Mm.
In the context of the Patterson Gimlin footage hitting the zeitgeist, it's pretty weird.
But I was just thinking about it as well. It wasn't with hair. It wasn't one of the leading songs in that of the soundtrack. Wasn't it The Age of Aquarius, The Dawning of the Age of Aquarius?
Exactly.
And what is The Dawning of the Age of Aquarius? It's a new time. It's a chaotic but freedom time.
And that's what Sasquatch represents, this chaos between the chaos of the wilderness and the upright walking structured nature of civilization. 3 weeks after the Patterson Gimlin encounter, the Rolling Stone premieres on the newsstands. And think of it, it's sitting next to the Wall Street Journal, it's sitting next to other ultra-conservative outlets, and then you've got this crazy rock and roll, you know, Rolling Stones magazine representing the chaos of the musical style, long hair, loud music and all that. It's this crossing over, just the the balance of the wild and the civilization.
I will say, it's a new idea to me. I don't think I'd ever considered Sasquatch in that function before.
And,
but
well, the human-primate interface was a surprisingly popular meme, he says, in all of the arts throughout the period. Several months after the Patterson-Gimlin film, on February the 8th, 1968, the first in the hugely successful Planet of the Apes film premieres. You can't tell me none of this is connected. There's something in the water. There's something in the air. Everyone's thinking about apes.
Well, that's,
wild, and then, crazy, yeah. Revolution, tearing down civilization.
But that's where it becomes a little bit more esoteric as well, in that, well, is it just because this was the zeitgeist for the time that Bigfoot that was filmed was actually a tulpa? Like, was that actually generating some type of form to then, in this weird kind of cyclic fashion, trigger all the other events?
He never says that. He never goes in that direction. And I don't think that's what he's arguing either.
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm just suggesting it.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. I think, like he said earlier, it points to an intelligence orchestrating something.
Yeah, you've just got to connect the dots.
For the people that are paying attention to go, oh, hang on a second. And then the final one he mentioned was in 1967, you had the peak popularity of the TV show The Monkees. Remember the ripoff of The Beatles?
Yes, they didn't even write their own songs.
That's a pretty weak. Well, Bigfoot couldn't write his own songs.
That's true. Yeah, good point.
That's the connection there. So if you put all those together, this picture starts emerging of this powerful force welling up in the collective psyche, a force simultaneously rooted in the intuitive, emotional aspects of our nature, as well as our more rational faculties. And he also adds, a month before the Patterson-Gimlin encounter, September the 17th, the rock group The Doors went on Ed Sullivan's show, and they I think Jim Morrison did a lyric about drug use, even when they told him not to. And then you had The Who destroying their instruments on the same night. And then Jimi Hendrix was like humping a speaker at a concert. It was just
good,
this
Jimmy.
Wild, wild behavior.
Yeah.
And we see this wild creature in the context of this time period. It's very strange. There's something strange about it. So it's just this, again, it goes back to the
symbols.
this big hairy Bigfoot is the symbol of the chaos of the 1960s.
It's almost like a marker in a way when you think about it, because that film has become not only a classic, it's universal. Like, everyone knows about that film.
Mm.
You know, so it's like a marker for the time, the chaos of the time.
And astrologically, again, this is his unique angle, the Patterson-Gimlin film took place during a powerful astrological alignment between, guess who, Uranus and Pluto. And this duo, Uranus and Pluto, is typically associated with revolutionary change, volatile emotions, wildness. Now, this is where we get to Loch Ness, the Loch Ness Monster. And he argues that the fascination, the modern fascination with Loch Ness, because obviously Loch Ness has been around for hundreds of years, but the term of calling the Loch Ness Monster, whatever the sighting is, a monster, that appeared specifically in 1933 on May the 2nd.
Yep, it did, absolutely.
Alex Campbell was a journalist who used the term. He wrote for the Inverness Courier, and then it just spread from there. It started to spread around the world. Less than 6 weeks before he wrote that article, Adolf Hitler began his establishment as dictator of Germany on March the 23rd.
So you mean a monster has arisen in the Loch? A monster
connection.
Has arisen in Europe?
And just 3 weeks before that, on March the 2nd, the world was introduced to a 14 creature with the film premiere of King Kong. Boom. It's all coming together. He says, with the coming out of the Loch Ness creature in the psyche in 1933, it's a surreal metaphor for the spirit of the era. Like the mid-1960s, powerful emotional energies are rising to the surface in constructive and destructive ways. Hitler and King Kong, virtually identical, both represent figures of immense power that grow out of control and terrorized civilized society, but then they ultimately destroy themselves. How can he argue with a comparison between Hitler and King Kong?
Well, this is the danger, though, of what's it called? It's like these correlations that you really can draw correlations between anything. Like, if you search deep enough, you can find a way to correlate things. And, like, he's making, at a surface level, what sounds like a very coherent argument, but also it's open to his interpretation. Like, he's interpreting King Kong as being, you know, this horrible monster, but wasn't King Kong just a, you know, not well understood, you know?
It's funny you say that, because I watched the recent film, and I was reading that as well. I was like, hang on a second. Isn't King Kong the good guy?
So is he saying that Hitler wasn't well understood? Like,
no, he's not saying that. But that, I think that's just a good example of how, in the times we're in, everything's turns upside down.
Absolutely it is.
King Kong is a monster. Yep. He destroys civilization. He rips apart buildings. He kills countless people.
Because he was taken from his homeland after being fed a couple of virgins, and then they took him out of his homeland. Like, they stole him, they took him away from where he was happy, you know, taking sacrifices, and they put him into the city. What else is he going
to
do?
To understand his reference, we have to watch the 1980s King Kong, because he's obviously not referring to the bald black and white one. He's referring to, like, the Universal Studios 1980-something King Kong.
Yeah.
So wasn't King Kong the bad guy in the 80s King Kong?
I think King Kong's always been the bad guy, but if you like just look at the, you know, at it a little bit deeper, you realize this is what happens when you take a wild animal out of its natural habitat and dump it in a city.
Right.
Of course it's going to be a monster.
Exactly, just like Hitler.
Yeah, you took Hitler out of the Bavarian Alps, you threw him into a city, and look what happened to him.
You take away his arts degree, you kick him out of art school, and you got a monster.
That's so bad.
And guess what was going on with the astrological configuration of the time in 1933?
Uranus.
Those same powerhouse planets, Uranus and Pluto.
What does Pluto have to do with that? Is that destruction? Isn't Pluto a destructive in astrology?
I don't know.
I'm not entirely sure. I thought Pluto was associated with destruction. Maybe I'm wrong on that one.
It's not even a planet.
Let me look it up.
Don't you listen to Neil deGrasse Tyson?
No, I don't.
He's looking it up. Just goes to Wikipedia, first result. Deep research.
There you go. Pluto, the planet of destruction and regeneration.
Wow.
So yeah, it's interesting that you've got this alignment of Pluto and Uranus and Hitler.
Well, this is the thing, is that the next alignment that has so many times in the past corresponded with horrific societal chaos and destruction is 2030. 2030 to 2031.
You know what? I believe that. I can see us on that path. I mean, already look what's going on now. I don't think things will get better in the next 10 years.
Mm. And there's a great story at the end, which I didn't really highlight, but I can talk about it. It's not really paranormal. It's just kind of a funny story. There is some interesting parts to it, though. 1996, he was invited to go to the Giza Plateau with his archaeological team. And it was an investigation with Boris Said, J.J. Hertak. You remember, have we talked about J.J. Hertak?
I think so.
He's a smart guy. Like, he's a scientist, and he has a bunch of, publications that have been published in journals. He's a respected scientist, or probably not respected, but he is a scientist.
Published articles, though. And
but he also is batshit insane. Like, he claims that he had an encounter with two celestial beings that told him, like, the keys of Enoch, and he has this weird set of teachings. I'll have to put.
Was that inside the pyramid? Is that the story? Is that the one?
I ran out of time because I wanted to go back to Hertak and go, hang on a second, what was so crazy about Hertak again? But
yeah,
you can't get his book in digital form, so I couldn't quickly grab it this afternoon. So maybe we'll
don't have it in our library.
No.
Oh, we have to get it.
No.
I love that you're just like, no, too crazy.
Hertak was organizing this, again, with Boris Said, and the Edgar Cayce Group, ARE, were involved as well. And they ended up asking Ray to join them on this expedition because his first book had just come out and they all really liked it. So they had permission from the Egyptian authorities, but, you know, Hertak was very open-minded. Said was like the, you know, hardcore archaeologist. But the reason they wanted to go to the Giza Plateau is there was this mysterious chamber. It's 100 feet underground, several hundred yards behind the Sphinx, but it's always been flooded, so no one's been able to safely get in there. But back in the mid-1990s, the water level started to recede for some reason, so there was an opportunity to actually go in and see what was down there, to explore. And of course, the reason why the Ed Cayce Group were involved, and Hertak, and probably Said to some degree, is this was close enough to be an entrance to the rumored Hall of Records that's supposedly under the Sphinx.
Yes.
Remember Edgar Cayce?
Robert Shockers had mentioned this, and I believe.
I think it goes back earlier to like the ancient Greeks talking about.
Yeah, it's in myth.
This Hall of Records that's been left by a previous civilization. But you know, most famously, Edgar Cayce stated that it's under the left paw of the Sphinx, or it's near the Sphinx. So they thought this might be an entryway. This is possible. So they went down to have a look and they found this incredible shaft, clearly this beautifully carved, polished shaft going straight down into this large gallery. It opened up into like a, almost like a temple, but it was completely ruined. It was flooded around. It's like the only place he could stand was this island in the middle of this kind of almost like an underground cave, but it's clearly man-made. And all they had permission to do was film. They weren't allowed to dig or excavate anything. And they always had a Egyptian antiquities authority guy just shadowing them. Like he couldn't get out of his sight. He was always watching everyone. You weren't allowed to touch anything. So during the filming, one of their camera guys is trying to get a better angle and he kind of stumbles on something that's on the rocks. And he looks down and he starts kind of moving his foot and he realizes that what he's standing on is not like the rest of the rock in this gallery. It's super smooth and polished. And they realize, holy crap, that this could be
like
another
manhole?
Like another entrance to something. Mm. It could be a sarcophagus. Who knows what this could be? So they bring down some guys with ground penetrating radar and they start to apply the radar to this slab of stone. It's quite big, this slab of stone. And there's a cavity in there. So immediately they're like, oh boy, like this could be, you know, this
yeah,
could,
the next Tutankhamun's tomb being open kind of thing.
Well, it could be another shaft that goes to the Hall of Records.
Yeah.
You know, word starts to get around, but they can't touch it. They can't do anything. They can't even, and if they know that if they just remove some of the dirt, they'll be able to know for sure that this is not a natural thing, that this is something man-made, and they'll get an idea of the period or they'll just get a clue as to what it could be.
Why are you saying that they can't? I mean, as due to Egyptian regulations?
Yeah, they're literally not allowed to touch anything. Like they can climb up the ladder and down the ladder and film and that's it. And there's that Egyptian antiquities guy who's just always watching them.
Hawass.
It's not Zahi Hawass. It's like one of his minions.
Right.
And it gets to the point where they're thinking, what are we going to do? And they're down there filming and one afternoon, the Egyptian antiquities guy desperately needs to take a shit. He really needs to go. He's doing the little dance. He's like, oh, come back. 10 minutes. I come back. He climbs up, like quickly climbs up the ladder, go and take a shit behind a camel or something. And Saeed and Hertak and Ray, they all look at each other.
But you can't give up this opportunity.
They don't say a word. Mm-mm. They just go straight to this stone. They just like digging with their fingernails in the dirt, like trying to clear as much as they can. Quick, before he comes, someone go and look out. They're just clearing it out. And this is what they uncover. You'll have to put this in the show notes. Can you see that? This weird stone thing.
What is it? It looks like
it's like a weird tetrahedron.
Yeah. I was just trying to, my mind was being, I couldn't work out what that shape is. It's.
Yeah. So.
It's like multifaceted, large,
obviously
polished stone.
Obviously something polished and carved.
But it's huge.
Could be a door.
What's the stuff on the left there? Is that just
Oh, that's just their fans to keep it cool.
And right.
Their filming equipment. Take a look in the show notes for this image. They're kind of amazed. And I'm not sure what happened when the guy came back after doing his business. They were just like,
what are you doing?
That's what it looked like before.
There's a hole dug in the ground.
It's always been like that. We didn't touch anything.
But it's obviously not, that's not a door, is
so,
it?
Okay, so word got around. The word started to spread that they had found something, okay? And as soon as word got around, all of a sudden they couldn't do anything. Like they weren't allowed to film anymore. They asked to go to another site. Nope, no permission. They asked to do something else. No permission.
Get out. Yep.
They asked to do something. No permission. Eventually, they had to leave. They had to pack up because they just couldn't go. They were blocked at every turn by the head of Egyptian antiquities, Zahi Hawass.
You know what they needed?
Either a German whore.
Yes.
Or a bag of money.
Exactly.
According to a certain von Daniken anecdote.
Yeah.
Exactly 1 year later, they're back in America. It's February the 16th, 1998. And, you know, Ray's back home. He opens a Chicago newspaper. And there's this story from Reuters. And it's got the headline, Egyptians find tomb of ancient god Osiris. He's like, hang on a second. He starts reading. Sinking water levels have revealed a granite sarcophagus of the ancient Egyptian god Osiris in a 30-meter deep tomb at the Giza pyramids, Zahi Hawass said on Wednesday. And the whole article, the whole article is about Zahi Hawass, like there's quotes of him going, I never excavated this shaft before because it was always full of water. But when the water went down about a year ago, I started the adventure. And you'll never believe what I discovered. Like he's just
what a bastard.
Exactly like he's and there's no mention of Saeed. There's no mention of Hurtak. It's like they're completely removed from the story. Zahi Hawass ended up getting a TV deal out of this where they opened up the sarcophagus live on television. There was nothing in it.
Yeah, right.
It was an empty sarcophagus.
Yeah, because probably Hawass has already opened it, taken out the whatever's inside and hidden it or sold it.
Or he's covered it up or what?
Who sold it off to the Middle East, a collector somewhere.
It's funny because There's always these stories about Hawass just doing something dirty to get the limelight, get the attention, and get the money in the end. And that's what he did. He made a bunch of money off this TV deal. So I thought that was kind of a funny, I called it the Hawass curse in there. But it is really the Hawass curse. Like if you listen to any Egyptologist who was working around that time, Zahi Hawass was like a thorn in your backside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just some of the anecdotal stories that we've heard of people that have literally been excavating in Egypt and the problems that they've had. And that was the joke. You know, von Daniken kind of threw out that the way that you distract Hawass is you get a German prostitute.
Yeah.
And apparently he was like obsessed with this prostitute's hair. And it's they funny. Asked, they said, can we do something? He's like, oh, yes. And then he goes back to the prostitute.
Sniffing the hair like Joe Biden. It's funny because there's anecdotes like Ray says in the book, he's like, well, I've heard, you know, all these horrible stories about Zahi Hawass, but I've also heard good things as well.
From his own press?
No, and he talks about this story where this American New Ager, and I can't remember her name, but you look her up and she's this blonde bombshell from the 90s, like, you know, big tits and nice long blonde hair, like a 9 out of 10. And Ray's telling the story about how Hawass was so generous and let her sleep over in the pyramid, the Great Pyramid one night without any
blonde
security or anything. And it's like, of course he did. He's got a thing for blonde European looking girls. Like that's just his thing. That's not evidence of him being this virtuous guy. He just wanted to impress
how nice of this sleazebag to allow a woman with large breasts inside the pyramid.
Yeah. I'm sure there would have been a few conditions with that overnight stay in the pyramid.
Where is it? It's too late now.
So
it's never too late for that horn.
That's the story from Ray Grass, The Sky Stretched Out Before Me. There's a ton of other essays in there. I only mentioned a few, so definitely worth checking out if you're not familiar with his work, as I was.
What do the other essays focus on? Is it similar stuff?
A few of them have been published in the Daily Grail's Dark Lore books, so they get very metaphysical and wordy.
Yeah, right, yeah.
One is on sending black evil arrows, which sounds kind of fun.
Is that like that magic I was describing with Maladoma, how his uncle, remember his uncle or his father fired that magical arrow?
Actually, no, I've just got open one of those weird African voodoo books I had. It's not even from his book. I don't even have it open. I do want to check out his other work, The Waking Dream, Unlocking the Symbolic Language of Our Lives, because I like that idea that there's something about, especially the synchronicities that enter the zeitgeist and they seem to influence a large amount of people.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting idea that it aligns with astrological, you know, planetary alignments, and it also aligns with, you know, the kind of symbology for what's happening in the culture at the time.
Yeah, this is kind of an extension. Now, Lauren Coleman, you know, never went in this direction, but Lauren Coleman did all this great research years ago about the contagious nature of the media, and this is well before social media. And so what he found was like that you would have a sudden spate of like mass shootings. You'd have a sudden spate of murders or suicides. And it was always after it had caught on in the media. It was like this weird contagion that would start happening. And I remember reading about this kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I wonder if there's a paranormal or, you know, paraphysical element that kicks in with this stuff as well. It's like it's the TV or the press might actually, you know, mediate people seeing this stuff, but then once it gets into enough people's minds, it builds a mass and then it starts actually manifesting out in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just described what happens with the modern media today.
Yeah, exactly.
They just seed some nonsense and it just becomes reality in people's minds.
Well, this is the thing, right? And so given what he was describing, you know, about being haunted by, you know, it was like this synchronicity of being haunted by something in his mind and then also physically, it makes me wonder if this is a larger kind of picture of like there's something as a society we're haunted by. And it leads to all these kind of disruptions and unsettling. And then, of course, when you throw in astrology, and I'm not so sure that I'm a firm believer of astrology, but the fact that he's, you know, throwing in there planets like Pluto, which are associated with destruction and the rise of Hitler, it is an odd coincidence. You got to give him that.
Yeah. I wonder what kind of cultural symbols and cultural synchronicities you would see in a different Yuga, like a different era.
Yes.
Because we're in the darker times.
Yeah.
You know, what would
like
you
at
see?
A golden age, you mean?
What would you see manifest in the golden age?
I think in the golden age, it wouldn't be so ambiguous. It would be very clear. It would be very clear. And you'd be able to see it because you're in the golden age. You'd be able to understand if.
Better wisdom. And
yeah, exactly. Oh, well, that connects with that. That makes perfect sense. But in this dark age that we're in at the moment, everything's kind of topsy turvy and being turned on its head and no one has any idea. So we're kind of clutching for whatever we can to get meaning. But I don't know, it's a really interesting theory. So I'll link to the book in the show notes. But let's just briefly touch, because I know we've gone for a little bit, but I want to mention Gog Magog. And I want to get into this because I want to actually pick up that PDF that you've got, Ben. I might steal it off you and we'll look into this in greater detail. Because what this relates to, it relates to a man by the name of Thomas Lethbridge. And this was investigated by Colin Wilson. And Colin Wilson came across the story of Lethbridge because, I mean, he was a fascinating man. And as I said, because he was independently wealthy, he didn't really care about what the university was instructing him on what he can look into and what he can talk about and what he can't.
He went against the grain. Good on him.
Yeah, well, look, you know, talking about potentially myth having a basis in reality or having a basis in fact, but also being associated with 18-foot giants flies in the face of the good name of Oxford University. Jeez, so they don't want him talking about
it. I don't know if they'd like all the phallic symbolism in this book. I'm just flicking through the images. My gosh.
Well, that does come up a lot. I don't know
There's
why.
There's a woman spread-eagled with two monkeys.
What does that relate to?
I've no idea. There's just a photo of a woman spread-eagled with two monkeys.
What, in chalk? Is it a chalk drawing?
I have no, it's a carving.
Because this is what, so all these drawings, they came up quite frequently, actually. So what happened with Lethbridge? Is that Lethbridge went over and started living in, he moved to Devon. I'm sorry, that's where he moved. And when he moved to Devon, he said that it was this weird, talk about synchronicities. It was like this weird synchronicity that took place that pushed his work in a particular direction. He said when they first moved in, their family saw this large white dog that was looking at them through this gate. Now, they went and asked the local farmer and they said, you know, what's with this dog? And the farmer's like, there's no such dog. And like, well, we saw it. We saw this large white dog. They later found out that this particular house was haunted by ghosts, but it was particularly haunted by the ghost of a large white dog. And multiple people had seen it in the area. So he thought, that's kind of strange. You know, why is this phantom dog hanging around at this house? Well, after this, I believe it was one of Lethbridge's family members or one person that Lethbridge was working with. He was digging out a trench underneath the house. And as he did, he found some archaeological remains. There was like a glazed floor tile that was there from the 14th century. And then there was like small remains of what appeared to be a white hare, but also a white dog. Now, these were symbols of the sun and the moon. And he realized that this might have some connection to an ancient pagan religion. There seemed to be something important about this particular site. And even though the connection was tenuous, there was something supernatural connected to the history of this area. So, of course, this got Lethbridge really interested in the history of the area, and he started absorbing all the ancient religion of pre-Christian Britain that was around this area. And as he started looking into it in greater detail, he came up with this story, or he heard this story from a local legend about a giant called Gog. Now, Gog, also known as Gog Magog, was this 18-foot tall man, essentially, like a part of a group of other giants that lived in this region before it fell back into Celtic kind of folklore, but it was before, apparently, according to the legends, Britain was even settled. So Britain was originally known, according to some legends, as I think it was it Albany? was what it was known as?
Albion.
Albion, I'm sorry. It was Albion. Yeah, that's right. So what had happened was, is according to the legends, is that there was this site where the Trojans, essentially, when they had been defeated in the, or had been fought in the Trojan War, the descendants of the Trojans actually fled across the sea. And as they fled, they went with Brutus. Now, Brutus went with a man by the name of Cornelius. Now, Brutus and Cornelius ended up going to Albion, which Brutus renamed Britain after himself.
Right.
So Cornelius ended up becoming Cornwall, right? So Cornwall, this, according to the legends in Greek mythology, was inhabited by a species or by a group of giants. So when they got there, these Trojans were like, well, we can't deal with this. We can't put up with the Trojans. So the Trojans killed all of them. Well, almost all of them. They left one behind. That was Gog Magog. And he was kept alive for a wrestling match with Cornelius. So Cornelius got into a fight with Gog Magog, this 18-foot giant.
Why would you mess with Gog Magog?
Who knows? But they got it. Well, apparently he was like a warrior. So they got into this fight, and Cornelius won because he threw Gog Magog off a cliff. And so Gog Magog died. But the legend goes is that this particular mound, the body of Gog Magog was buried in this mound and kind of left to history. But all these chalk outlines and these pictograms have been left at this site of these large creatures that were essentially the giants. But what was odd is that throughout the years, and this is what Lethbridge uncovered, he went looking for history. And it's funny how, like when I was saying before that we were looking for ancient history, and when we find something that's ye olding English, it's hard to get information out of it. He went back even further and tried to find reports of legends that come from this particular mound, potentially supernatural legends that come from this mound. And one was, is that at, apparently there was paranormal activity that was taking place that was reported in 1150. There was a local priest. Now this local priest had reported reports of people had recorded, I'm sorry, reports of people claiming that they'd seen something like a spectral giant hanging around at this particular location. So it's almost like the ghost, potentially, of Gog Magog is haunting his mount. But it's odd that it's on this particular site. Like, even let's say if that's just all superstition, it's strange that you've got this report from the 1100s of there being a ghost of a giant in this particular location.
I'm just kind of scanning through the Colburn document for the word giants, because I think exactly what you're describing is written in a slightly different way in the Colburn.
Right.
Post-Ice Age Britain is still inhabited by painted men, which is the Picts, and a few still surviving over 9 foot tall giants who were survivors of the cataclysm from the previous civilization.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go.
So there wasn't like a civilization. There's just a few of them left around.
And that's exactly what seemed to happen here, is that there were just a few of them that were left. Obviously, a population of them.
Poor little guy. He was just lonely.
Well, no, there was another.
And then they kidnapped him and challenged him to a fight.
And then killed him.
And then killed him.
Yeah, so it didn't go very nicely. But what was strange is that when Lethbridge...
Oh, there's a picture of Gog Magog here.
Let me see.
The legendary Cornelius and Gog Magog.
Oh, there you go.
The giant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. 6 cubits tall.
Which is 18 feet.
The same builders of the great temples. I got to go back to this Colburn document and connect all this.
Yeah, we need to have a look into it in more detail. But essentially what ultimately happened with this is Lethbridge found that these reports, there's a legend. And the legend was, is that someone had actually also gotten into a fight with the spirit at this particular site.
Mm.
And this came, the problem was that the story of this came from a priest who didn't have a good reputation, Lethbridge found out. Because even though being a priest, apparently he was quite nasty. And in fact, had even skited about the fact that he had knocked some girl up or had gotten some harlot and had basically written false stories about her because he wanted to get rid of her and had her burnt as a heathen.
Oh, that's...
And he was very proud of that. So you can't necessarily rely on the report. But he said that in his reports that someone had apparently gotten into a fight with one of these spirits and had speared it, had actually somehow speared it. And what it did is it left a hole, an opening to this other world that would always open up every year at the same time. So every year annually, you would have this opening, and this is why people would start seeing phenomena, which apparently has been repeating all the way into modern times. So Lethbridge, though, was trying to prove that, look, maybe there is something at this particular site. Like, maybe there is more to it. And maybe this we can find some fact in it. So Lethbridge came to this archaeological, practicality in getting access to this particular site. So he took this large metal pole. And what he did is he drove this metal pole into the ground. And so over the years, obviously, because of layering and, you know, filtering and everything kind of, you know, falling down, he figured that the soil would be at least 2 feet deep at the locations where this particular potential tomb might be. So what he did is he went with this pole and started jamming this pole in at regular intervals around this site until he found these 2 feet intervals. And he did it. And what he found is that rather than being a depiction of just one god at this site, because it was all chalked out, like when he revealed it and pulled it back, it revealed that there was chalk, of this ancient chalk. But his colleagues actually thought that he had drawn some of them.
Oh.
And this is why he, you know, ended up getting into... But he claims he didn't. He's adamant that he didn't. And his theories are quite fascinating. But with doing this, he ended up finding that there wasn't just one giant depicted here. There was two. There was Gog and Magog. So Gog-Magog is actually, what he found out from his research, two giants.
Oh.
There was Gog and there was Magog.
Was Magog a female giant?
Well, we don't know, but maybe.
Probably.
And so over the years, the story, obviously being this ancient legend, has transformed into Gog-Magog. But it was Gog and Magog. And that's to the point where I got, because he found there were other depictions as well of like gods and
I feel, you know, sorry for them.
But yeah, so these poor, this is the thing, you know, these
poor
giants,
big guys
that had survived
just
some
dumb big giants.
Yeah, they've survived some global cataclysm, which has wiped out most of the rest of the living creatures on Earth.
I can see them there on the isle when the ancestors of ancestors of the Trojans arrive and they're like, small human friend.
Yeah.
And they bring them like a present or something and the human's just like, stabs them.
Well, they were angry after the war. I'm not making excuses for him. It's wrong, but you know, this is terrible. So we will look into that more, because it's fascinating, because it's more of this, even though it's mythology, right? You can see how it kind of starts coming together, and it's great that you've got these archaeologists that are willing to kind of break them all, because they're not restricted by money and funding. And you know, I heard this great quote the other day as well, and this is what I think is really important, particularly when you're looking at this stuff and actually in light of what we're going through at the moment. At one point in history, the accredited scientists of the time told us that the world was flat. You know, they told us that the sun went around the earth. You know, these were the leading scientists of the time that the people had to trust.
Trust the science.
Don't trust the science.
Have you seen there's a new Flat Earth documentary coming out this year?
No. Yeah, like, people actually believe that there's Flat Earth.
They're touting it as the first Flat Earth feature film. Oh. And it's got like a big budget.
Okay, in this circumstance, do trust the science. Like, I'm all for, you know, questioning.
No, but those Flat Earthers are just following your advice.
Not when there's overwhelming evidence in the contrary of your theory.
Well, yeah, some evidence is self-evident.
Like the guy,
you don't need to read it in a book to understand it's true.
I saw a guy that took a bubble level on a plane, and when they got to cruising altitude, he's like, "See, the bubble hasn't moved." It's like, mate, where do I start?
I don't know. Those flat Earth guys have some good arguments. I'm not so close-minded as to not hear their argument.
No,
I might watch that doc. Maybe we should interview the director on the show.
Not too sure how well that would go, but it could be good for a laugh. Maybe
it's like some of those authors who are just really persuasive. They're like, because that's what I remember using that analogy on a previous show, that you'd have to have like the Steve Jobs of flat earthers.
Yeah.
He's just so charismatic and he uses his Steve Jobs reality distortion field that by the end of talking to him, you're like
oh yeah,
the earth probably is flat.
Yeah. I can't believe I've been walking around thinking that the earth is round. Yeah, what's wrong with me?
I'll be interviewed for your documentary. Sure, you can use the Mysterious Universe logo. Why not? I believe you. It's to be one of those guys who's so convincing.
No.
He's really handsome. He's like a massive Chad as well. He goes to the gym. He's really cut.
Yeah, he's got the halo
he's
effect.
Eloquent, great vocabulary. Yeah.
How can a guy that ripped be wrong?
He arrives in like a 911 turbo. He's clearly successful. He's got like 100 Bitcoin. And he just sits down and convinces you very eloquently that the earth is flat.
It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. No, it's just, it's never going to happen.
Sign me up. Don't trust the science.
Don't trust the science. Sometimes trust the science. That's where I'll end on that one.
That's a wrap for the show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. We'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.